Okay, so welcome to session 3D, operationalization of LEGIC ICAP. Can regulation spawn innovation? And conjures up all sorts of interesting things. I'm sure we're in for an interesting time today. Our presenters are Carolyn Bennett and Trang Duncanson from Deloitte's. Carolyn's the lead partner for Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants, has more than 15 years' experience in the Australian financial services industry, and specialises in financial and risk management for banks and insurance. She has experience in a range of countries, including Australia, New Zealand, USA, UK, and Asia, which is not a country. Yes. Okay, we'll stop there. I'm sure you all know Carolyn, and I'm sure you also know Trang. Trang has been in life insurance industry for some 15 years, with a wide array of financial services companies specialising in regulatory change, or SNAP, and the financial operational modelling implications for life insurers. Trang leads Deloitte's actuarial life insurances community, driving the topical research to their life insurance clients. I asked Trang for something that you didn't know about her, or else what she did in her spare time, and she told me body combat, so I don't know which one that was for, but there's an interesting thing about Trang. So let's get straight into it. So over to you, Trang. Oh, and just while she's going up there, when you speak later on, please speak into the microphone so it can be recorded. Thank you.
Okay, LEGIC ICAP. You wonder, with all the talk out there on ICAP, what should the end goal be? What should be our ambition? There's going to be two critical things that will make your ICAP program successful. And they also happen to be the two key challenges that your firms will likely face. Number one will be the operationalization of the process, and two, the delivering of the innovation. So this is what we're going to cover today. I will cover, what are we going to cover today, the background, why all this focus on LEGIC ICAP, and then also just give you an ICAP framework in practice. We're going to cover the...
Never work with children, animals or computers.
The concept of operationalization. What it means, we're going to share with you some lessons from our UK colleagues on their experiences on the ORSA, which is the equivalent to the ICAP here in Australia. Caroline's going to cover off the tools and techniques that your firm can use to help you embed the ICAP process. And obviously we're going to cover the key challenges that you will likely face in trying to do that. And lastly, spawning innovation. We have to do this. So how are we going to extract the business benefits from it? So what's all the fuss about the ICAP? You can actually see from the quotes that we have there that the key issues actually lie in the engagement throughout the firm and then also the operationalization of the risk appetite. The key questions are firms able to link their activities? Are they really able to link their activities to the level of risk that the board will accept? And then, is the level of risk able to be covered by the available capital? Now, APRA said in February 2012, in one of their industry speeches, that across the industry, and in their view, there was a questionable level of engagement with the board in the setting of the risk appetite. They said there was a lack of analysis in using stress testing and scenario techniques. And then lastly, they said, in their view, there was a disconnect between the risk appetite statement and its translation into the operational management of the firm. So clearly, operationalization is going to be one of the key challenges that firms are going to face during 2012 and beyond. The ICAP process. We've got a definition up there, a description. Now, interestingly, that description, we didn't take from any of the APRA responses, we took that from the ORSA description. And why we did that was because today we are going to share with you some of the experiences that we've had on ORSA in Europe. But then if you look at that definition, that is the LAGIC ICAP. So it is the process of identifying, measuring, monitoring, and also managing your risks, and then assessing that with your available capital for the risks that you do take on. So with this slide, what we wanted to highlight is you need to differentiate between the process and the ICAP document. The ICAP document itself, or the report, you know, it exists in various forms within an organisation. But it's the process that is the key, and it's the process that is where there's going to be the biggest change. And why do we say that? It's because it is more than just systems and models. It does require the relevant people in your firm to be able to work together effectively under a common risk vision, which is your risk appetite, and then to act accordingly. This is what the ICAP looks like in practice. It's just our depiction of it. But essentially, it's the interlinkage between the risks that you do take on, the risk profile, the risks the insurer is willing to accept, the risk appetite framework, your business strategy, and how that all combines and how it impacts the capital adequacy of your firm for the level of risk that you do take on. And it's a one-year time frame as well as in future years. So the key thing we wanted to ask here is there is the framework of the ICAP, but how do we get insurers to actually live and breathe this process? Concept of operationalisation. Now, Solvency II in the UK is actually ahead of us in terms of understanding its ICAP, or the ORSA, as it is called there, and then also, obviously, the challenges that the firms actually face. So to help understand or explore this concept, we have a video next of one of our colleagues, Keith Bevan, who explains what operationalisation means to him.
One of the ways of best telling whether a risk appetite framework is fully embedded is by looking for some core behaviours that you get across an organisation. So, for example, if you have conversations with the chief risk officer or the senior executives, they'll be able to give you real examples where the risk appetite framework has meant that decisions have been made to either change risks, add more risk, or even take risk away. And it's that creating that dynamic where it's part of decision-making is a core part of operationalising the risk appetite framework. One of the other ways that it's definitely worth considering is that it needs to be integrated within the strategic objectives of the organisation. If the strategic objectives of the organisation are heading off leftwards and the risk appetite is heading towards the right, those two don't work together, in which case it will never be embedded properly. So you need to make sure that the risk appetite framework is integrated and consistent with the strategic objective of the organisation.
And then when we interviewed him and asked him what would be the key challenge that insurers faced in implementing the ORSA, this was his reply.
The Solvency II journey has been quite a long journey for European insurers. Probably the first conversations about Solvency II started around 10 years ago. The real bulk of detail came out about 5 years ago. And over that period, during the journey, a lot of surprises have come through in terms of the regulations as they've developed. And to be honest, because we still haven't got the full details of regulations, I think potentially there's some prizes still to come for insurers, which I'm sure they'll love to be challenged with over the next few years. The key areas probably for systems of governance and required function that have been a surprise is the level of evidencing and documentation that's been required. A lot of European insurers currently have a good quality framework in place, but they've actually had to develop and work on developing a lot more evidencing that actually that process does work and developing the required reporting to really be able to demonstrate to the regulators that that's happened.
So here are the lessons from the UK and Europe in relation to the ORSA in practice. The first one, introducing the ORSA is a demanding task. There is no mechanical way of conducting an ORSA, and often, they say often, a cultural change is required at both the board level and within the organisation. They say that to introduce the ORSA effectively, a top-down process is required. And the statement there is, models cannot replace leadership. So the chairman of the EOPA late last year said that the ORSA is the heart of Solvency II. So in our view, in the same way, the operationalisation of the ICAP would be central to the success of your LAGIC program. Here is a risk appetite setting framework and the cascading. Most firms have this in bits and pieces in one form or another, but there's two things that we wanted to highlight here which would be the key challenges in implementing such a framework. The first one, to be able to communicate and cascade it effectively. Here the key questions are, do you have a risk appetite framework that is well established, well understood, and then are the relevant people in your firms empowered to challenge the decisions with reference to that risk appetite framework? The second challenging aspect, action and correction. To be able to demonstrate that the trigger events will actually lead to appropriate actions. In fact, LPS 220, as you would know, refers to the severity, speed, and adequacy of management response. So operationalisation actually requires the linkage of the risk appetite to the strategic objectives of the firm, the linkage of the risk appetite to the LAGIC ICAP. So in effect, operationalisation means the evidencing and the living and breathing of the ICAP process. I'll just have Caroline come up now and walk you through some of the tools and techniques you can use to actually help embed the ICAP process.
So now we just wanted to really talk a bit further about what might this look like in reality. It's it's the step beyond the strategy and the preferred outcomes, but really what might it mean in a day-to-day sense. And so, firstly, whatever people build needs to be practical and able to be used at a day-to-day decision-making sense. That means there are risk tolerances and limits at the level in the organisation that decisions are made, and that would usually be the business unit. Secondly, are risk and capital integrated in the way that is intended? And I'll talk a bit further in a second about what that means in terms of integration of models particularly. Thirdly, as Trang touched on, is particularly about communication and how people communicate and whether what is communicated can be understood by the users. And so that really goes to the question of dashboards, of how scenarios and stresses are used and so forth. And finally, the feedback loop, that there is a clear action following outcomes. And of course, wrapped around that is, of course, that whatever you put in place is appropriate to the size, complexity, and so on of the organisation. We thought it might be useful to actually get slightly granular, in terms of how an organisation might have approached this question. And this is an example not from Solvency II, but in fact from a large age and life insurer. Given the time scales we're supposed to be working within today, we won't go into all of the detail here. But I guess the key points were really, firstly, that the application, for example, of risk limits, which is what we show here, is done at a level which is impacting the day-to-day operations that you can see as we work through the various risk categories. There are very specific limits at a granular level that someone can actually make a call as to whether activity is tracking within or without these areas. Secondly, the key point we wanted to highlight is that not only the person designing the framework needs to agree that these are the things that are in there, but the business decision makers need to agree that the areas being monitored are actually the right areas, and that also the people monitoring the activities, for example, the risk management function, are able to monitor what is being measured as well. Accountability is a key topic that Trang started to touch on, but that's particularly important in this type of framework in terms of really mapping responsibilities very clearly across the organisation and making sure that where there are changes to what might be the case today, that those are managed effectively such that the go-forward structure gets the outcomes that are desired. And dashboards are another key part of what people have found to work particularly effectively overseas. And that's really about providing the risks and the information in a way that people can very clearly and quickly identify where they need to focus their energy and their effort. And this is a follow-on piece of information from the example, just in terms of how that organisation started to track what was going on in the portfolio following the implementation of the framework that we touched on. APRA has also made it very clear that it's the role of senior management to give boards information that they need to make this framework work. And so too often we know that the information that does go to boards is very complicated, often very lengthy, and difficult for them to necessarily identify where the key areas are. So I guess the challenge that we would put to people as they contemplate the ICAP and how they might innovate is there a different way to communicate around these topics that will really enable all of those who need to be involved to actually get inside what's going on and understand the decisions that they're being asked to make. Another key area is clearly the modelling. While it's not the answer to the ICAP, but it is important that any modelling that is done is integrated to the whole process. And as has been said by the regulators in Solvency 2, if the organisation doesn't trust its model well enough to use it, why would the regulator? And that's clearly a very sensible view. But what does that mean for an organisation? Well, you have to be able to demonstrate that the model is used for a range of areas, that it is an important tool and part of decision-making processes within the organisation, is a sound model, has sound governance, has sound controls around the model such that people can have confidence that it will be used, that the organisation believes that it's a sensible tool, and therefore that the regulator can similarly. Finally, on stress and scenario testing, which is clearly another key part of the ICAP framework, we have just an example here of how one might work through a particular situation. But really the key point we did want to highlight here was, firstly, that, again, the model alone is not the answer, but that, secondly, there is more to be done in terms of thinking through scenarios and stress levels, and particularly overlaying the judgment to the situation to fully understand the risks rather than necessarily just modelling different situations. So then we wanted to conclude this section of the presentation with really just a summary of where, I guess, we saw some of the key challenges to operationalisation. It's a very tricky word that Trang put in the title. And so what we have here is essentially a variation of the a slide, in fact, from Gabrielle Bernardino that Trang referred to earlier. And it tries to highlight, I guess, the view of the supervisor in terms of how this framework might work. But really, as Trang said, this does translate almost perfectly to the LAGIC environment as well. And where we see the key challenges, firstly, the ICAP is really not just about documentation. It is probably the case that less documentation but more thoughtful documentation may in fact be the better outcome. The consideration of dashboards in particular could well be an opportunity to remove what is probably redundant documentation in existing processes. Secondly, as touched on earlier, the evidencing is a non-trivial task. In actually proving that the behaviours and the processes have changed is one of the more substantive tasks here rather than less. And that the skills needed to do that successfully are actually a different set of skills to those that perhaps people might think. It is those change skills that are going to be truly required to succeed. And thirdly, this is more than just a regulatory change. It is an opportunity to make a substantive change to how these activities are managed within an organisation for a particular outcome, and that it therefore should be integrated with other change initiatives for organisations, whether that be cost reduction, be M&A, be finance transformation and so on. And now we'll come to the concluding piece around innovation.
I've got a bit of time, so can I just share with you, operationalisation is an eight-syllabled word, and that I can actually say that, and this is coming from someone whose original language is only one-syllabled for every word, so that's actually quite good. And the second thing I wanted to share with you was in practising this speech, my five-year-old can actually say this word now, and not only that, she can spell it, so I'm very proud of it. So, operationalisation... Can regulation actually spawn innovation? Okay. So Deloitte actually conducts an annual survey of Solvency II, and this is showing the fourth annual Solvency II survey, and it looks at European insurers' progress as well as their preparedness and the challenges that they face. And earlier this year, we gathered similar feedback from Australian insurers. And what we got from that feedback was basically saying that the key implications of LAGIC were going to be in the areas of introducing new risk mitigation techniques. And that is very similar to Solvency II there that you can see from our Deloitte UK survey. And the second area where it was going to be a key implication for LAGIC, enhancing systems and procedures. So, how will organisations embed and evidence the risk and capital processes in their firms? The solution to this will likely be where the innovation will lie. So what we talked to you today, we talked through some of the tools and techniques that you can use to embed the ICAP process. We talked through stress testing, some of the scenario planning techniques. We talked through the articulated risk limits down into the shop floor. We touched on risk dashboards as a tool to communicate. And then lastly, the capital models, the integrated use of capital models and the demonstrated use of it through to business decision making. So we have to do this. I mentioned this. We have to do this. So how do we extract business benefits from it? So we wanted to leave you with these questions on the concluding slide. And the key message really is, in the first step of your ICAP program, you need to consider, you need to ask yourself, what is my organisation's ambition level? That's it.
Okay, thank you. So, questions. Must be lots. Or observations. Is anyone doing this? Is anyone, well, not even ICAP, but is anyone operationalising risk effectively? Engineering companies have been doing it for decades, centuries maybe. What about financial services companies? Okay. So a question for Trang or Caroline. What do you think, where are we as an industry? I have a hypothesis, we've got a long way to go. What do you think?
I was going to say we had a discussion with APRA very recently, and it was very clear, you know, during 2012, everyone's sort of heads down trying to implement this ICAP. So really, that's where we're at by the end of 2012. But really what APRA was saying, and I do agree with that, is that, you know, 60 or 70% of the effort is going to be beyond that. It's going to be in this area of operationalising the actual ICAP process. And it was very clear that to be very successful in this program, to be successful in the way that the regulator requires you to be here, and even in the UK and Europe, you do actually need to focus on this.
Any questions or comments? What about the... Oh, yes. Wayne?
Trang, do you think APRIA have a clear view of what this looks like? Because I'm not here,
for the benefit of the tape, the question was, do APRA know what this actually looks like?
Well, as you would know, APRA is coming out with further guidance on the ICAP, September 2012. That's quite late, obviously. But even when they do come out with that guidance, it is expected to be principles-based, and this is coming from APRA. You may have heard that, APRA saying that, and we have heard APRA saying that to us one-on-one. So it will be principles-based. But in the meantime, they do expect organisations to start on this journey and actually get it happening, regardless of that September 2012 deadline.
Yes, Phil. Yes, please, yes.
Phil Stott, contractor actuary. I've just come back from 18 months overseas doing a lot of Solvency II work in the UK, because as you appreciate, there's quite a lot of work over there at the moment, or at least a lot of activity. It's probably a better way of describing. I'd like to endorse what you said about the need to embed things. But my perception, having worked with in a number of organisations over there, is that they're really being dragged, kicking and screaming into this, and even with the stringent requirements of Solvency II, a lot of companies just aren't getting the message yet that you've actually got to make this the way your business works. I think there's going to be a lot of surprises in store. And if we don't sort of come to the party in the same way in Australia, we're going to have the same experience.
Yeah. Can I add to that? And Caroline can add to it. The Solvency II journey has lasted a lot longer than it's been here. And I think, you know, they're very, very fatigued. And a big chunk of that has been in the implementation of Pillar 1. So really, quite frankly, a lot of firms right out there right now are just exhausted with this whole issue. And you get a lot of thought leadership coming out of Europe right now around the people cost and the people impact and so on, because this thing is now extended another year, actually, to 2014. So it's been really demanding over there, yes, I agree.
So it's not going to happen in 2014.
It has been extended, yeah. But, I mean, it's very... It's a lot more complex over there, because they are going through, like, full internal model validation, partial and so on. And it's the life insurance industry here, or even the general insurance industry, is nowhere near that sort of level of complexity or consideration at this point.
I think the interesting thing has been, though, that over the life of the Solvency II journey particularly, organisations went from wanting to get benefits to wanting to comply, and have now squarely, based on particularly the input of our colleagues in the UK and particularly the surveys they've been doing, over the time has gone from benefits to compliance, and now has come squarely back to we need to get benefits out of this. And really this is where this part of the framework is where you can get the benefits. So that is where people are putting their energy.
And I forgot one other thing our UK colleague was saying, was that in the UK they are a lot more advanced with Solvency II, whereas continental Europe, that's probably where you're hearing a lot of the kicking and fussing. Yep. Oh, is it? Oh. There you go.
I understand that Europe would be a lot worse.
Yeah.
But the other comment I'd like to make as well is your slide about can regulations form innovation. I asked the question, I think you sidestepped the question a little bit, because yes, it will spawn change, but unless you believe the change is necessary innovation.
Yeah.
I
mean, innovation is a very exciting sort of word, isn't it? So that's a full spectrum of innovation, that is true. But it does link in very nicely with Todd Sampson's sort of presentation this morning, so maybe I should say creativity. So spend that extra 5 minutes when you're planning your ICAP program to actually try to extract the business benefits from it. The 5 minutes longer to be braver than the next person, yes.
And in terms of being brave, make the observation that we as a profession should be engaging with the companies, either whether you work for consultants or within an organisation, and being part of this conversation. There's quite a lot of cultural change, and we do have a lot to add to that. So I think it's definitely worthwhile getting in there now and trying to help people understand what it is and realise it's going to be an ongoing journey. Owen.
Owen Wilmot from Zurich. Thanks for your presentation, and the organisation that you guys are with also, you know, and you've touched on it in your presentation, did a survey on readiness. One of the questions that you asked about in the readiness survey was attitudes within the various organisations to whether this initiative, this development, this program, if you like, of Capital Review represents an opportunity or a burden. I mean, there were four. You know the one I mean, Carolyn. Mm. And I mean, I think that probably a very high percentage responded at the minimal level. That is, that they just saw this as a compliance task that had to be done. Yeah. So in some ways, I wonder whether you're trying to sort of nail jelly to a tree by can this spawn innovation? You know, you're scratching where the industry doesn't itch, I don't know.
Yeah, I think because, you know, ICAP's been talked about a lot in the last half year in particular. We really wanted people to really step back and think about this when you do put your LAGIC program together, that it can be more than just compliance. And in fact, when we spoke to APRA a few weeks ago about the perceived level of benefits that the industry was saying they were going to get out of this, you know, obviously APRA wasn't so happy about the fact that it was very lukewarm, the sort of replies. But what they were interested in was basically, you know, in 2 years' time, will the industry sort of come around and actually see that there are actually benefits to this?
And, I mean, I think the reality is that this is the path APRA has gone down, and it's also the path that is being gone down globally. And it's certainly better to go down a path that's consistent with that, that does get you some benefits, than to be dragged down that path by someone else that may not get you benefits, but you'll still go down the path. That's just my personal view. But,
yeah, if I may sort of add my point, that's your point about whether it's a benefit or compliance is really very interesting one, because people have answered that it's compliance issue. I don't think, grasped the reality that if it's just compliance, then it won't be compliant. And so it won't be if you're just doing it for compliance, then you fail.
Yep.
Deb Jones, Bretton Watson. I think this, I'm very strongly reminded, listening to you talk about this process, of quality control in manufacturing. It was the buzzword, it was going to revolutionise people's business, it was going to turn them all into super Japanese companies, and it became a ticker box process. It became a documentation process, and for a lot of companies, arguably delivered no benefit. And this, we're coming at this from a different point of view. We're coming at it from the regulator telling us we've got to do it, but maybe if we really thought it through, we could turn it around and go the other way than what the quality control process, and turn it into something that's a real benefit for our companies. Secondary, I'm working in a friendly society environment, not a life insurance or a general insurance environment when I'm looking at LAGIC. So I think the challenge is going to be making sure that as actuaries, we're not the custodians of this process. Mm. They have to be the custodians. They're used to us being the custodians of their compliance. And we don't want, the whole idea of this is that that should no longer be the case, in my opinion.
David Tu, BT Financial Group. Thank you for your presentation. Definitely in agreement with the intent of trying to get value out of LAGIC and ICAP. Just interested in your views. So ICAP's been in place for ADIs in Australia for, you know, 5-6 years. Interested in your views on whether that has spawned innovation in the banking sector, and then any learnings that we can take away from that.
I think, and again, others in the room may have different perspectives, but there's probably more intent, I would say, behind the way this is being implemented for insurers than perhaps the way it was for the banks. That, you know, at the outset, perhaps the banks had in many instances gone down more of a document-based process, and while other activities were going on, it probably didn't get to the full integration of risk and capital as is intended here, and was intended in banking, but has that been fully tested? Probably not. I think certainly some banks would say that it hasn't. But the intent with which the regulator is talking about it in the insurance context in Australia is, I think, at a different level perhaps than what that the same regulator perhaps did in banking at the outset. Just my personal view.
Okay, well, I think it's time to leave it there. Morning tea or afternoon tea is now on. So would you like to join me in thanking Caroline and Trang? Thank you very much.